A wonderful session today with Michelle Indiguocello, who has a new album called Comet Come to Me that follows up her release celebrating the music of Nina Simone. Michelle was one of the first artists signed by Madonna to her Maverick record label in the 90s and had a hit on her first album with If That's Your Boyfriend, He Wasn't Last Night. She has explored so much music since then. We'll talk after this performance of the song Oyster.
Somebody wishing on a shooting star. Shooting star streams across the sky. You know it's just a meteorite. People throwing pennies in a wishing well. Wishing well's gonna run dry. But I ain't gonna leave you tonight. Everybody talks about changing the world. The world ain't ever gonna change. But you can always change in front of me. I'll shuck all the oysters, you keep the pearls. I do my shucking and my jiving for free. Free. Like walking down the beach at night. Throw a bunch of lines out to the one you want. Till you get it right. Sometimes you don't get it right. Sometimes you don't. Get it right. But when you do, it's out of sight. Sometimes you don't get it right.
That is a live version of Oyster by our guest today, Michelle Indiguocello. Her new album is called Comet Come to Me. Before that, she released Pour un Homme Souverain, a dedication to Nina Simone. And I asked her if making that album and performing Nina Simone's songs had an effect on making this new album.
Of course it did. I mean, I was very excited to get back to my own music. Just in the sense that her music is very heavy emotionally. And telling that story over and over again was hard to do sometimes. Telling her story or giving my perspective to what I've read was hard. So I think there was times in the tour bus or the times I would be off tour that a lot of writing took place. And so I think that's what you hear in Comet Come to Me. It's just going back and trying to get a hold of what I was thinking or feeling musically.
Mm. Yeah, I want to say, and correct me if I'm wrong, but this doesn't seem like there's not a real pattern to this album. You did not collect things that all fit one theme on this album. What you say is more accurate. These are things that just came to you as you were, out in between albums there.
Yeah, out in the world. I mean, the common thread, I think, is just humanity. There's a lot of co-writes on the record, which I really enjoyed doing. I think artists after a certain age or after doing so many of their own projects can become myopic. And it was also great to take all those songs or ideas, cells that I had, and share them with others to create other things out of them. So that was exciting for me.
It's funny about you talk about wanting to bring all these people together because you are a known introvert. And
yes.
Are you ever the kind of person who just huddles with their laptop?
Oh, always. Yeah, I would be now if I wasn't here with you.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, that's my, you know, I'm not online a lot. I use Logic, so that's my, I create my own little sonic world within that on my laptop. But that's, again, what I like about bringing other people in to work with or create with, collaborate with, because I sit there on my computer and I'm just there. I'm clear that these are just ideas for other people to bring life to, you know, and to make my little idea grander. So that's all. It's again why I enjoy music.
And the sound of this record is clearly not a laptop record. You
spent
some time in the studio, so.
Yeah, that's the only thing I don't like about modern technology is I really like a studio and a board and microphones and so sonic expertise, you know.
Just to follow up a little bit on that, on the Nina Simone tour, you're right about the emotion and the heaviness of a lot of her work. Were there ways did you get, when you went out to perform those every night, did it affect you emotionally in the rest of your life?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. In her book, I Put a Spell on You, she talked about how hard it was to do some of those songs because it would weigh on her. But even some of the ballads that were written by other people, the heaviness that they bring is just so apparent. And I must admit, it was starting to affect especially Chris and I. It was just heavy music to do, and I would try to inform people about her and read parts about her life, and she really had a difficult time. I envy her talent, but I do not envy her life. You know, I don't envy some of the choices and the anger, but again, I have no idea. That's the other thing. Somebody would always try to make a comparison, and there's no way I could understand to be black and a woman in that time, because it is, people talk about everything but the burden. I mean, I'm black, I'm gay, I'm a woman, I am just all burden. So going out and doing her music was mentally challenging, vocally challenging, and just intense, an intense time.
Did people who knew her want to talk to you about her?
Oh, yes. And they would want to do something weird that borderline on necromancing, as if I could channel her. And I was like, we are two different people. And so that was hard, too. And, it became like almost people wanted it to be an act. Like they would get mad if I didn't wear my daishiki so they could have that experience as well, you know? It just became a challenge.
I've always been kind of amazed by your career. Looking back to the time with Maverick either, right? Here's kind of a major label that after the first couple of records, I think you personally made a decision that you weren't going to play all the games you needed to play to be a superstar, and you started doing your own art, and they really stuck with you, and I thought that was admirable.
Oh yeah, I mean she's a maverick, she's a visionary, and so is Freddie DeMann, who was my go-between at the label. I mean, I think also that was a time where, either way, I was a great tax write-off. It was a win-win situation for them.
Oh, man.
I don't think I sold as much, but I definitely am grateful that they were my patron for a while to aid me in realizing that you do get to a fork in the road and you have to decide which way you're going to go. And I just think it was out of naivete and also just an inability to participate in the zeitgeist in a certain way I wasn't really good at. So here I am now. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. We should say that the she you're referring to is, of course, Madonna. That was her label. And also, yeah, do you remember the kind of when you figured out, oh, man, this is a tough row, and I don't think I want to do this? Because you had a fair amount of success with those first couple of albums. It's just like everybody's looking for the next step, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think Bitter was the moment of realization.
Mm-hmm.
It was a lot more acoustic. Matter of fact, I had made the first two records with a producer named David Gamson, who's like now responsible for the hits of Kelly Clarkson and others.
Mm-hmm.
But him and I really had a connection as well. And I really liked, I really enjoyed making the first two records, and I didn't really see changing. So I started Bitter with him, but then the label wasn't really... They felt he had did what he could. They wanted me to work with someone else. That didn't work out. My budget was minuscule, and so I had to call the favor of a true friend, Craig Street, who did Nora Jones and Joe Henry. I mean, he's responsible for a lot of amazing records, but he's also the person that when I came to New York at 20, took my tiny little demo and helped me meet people and had great faith in me. He propelled me on this path, helped propel me on this path. He gave me the feeling I could. So I made Bitter, and then that's when I realized that people really do expect something similar or the same
yeah.
as what you did previously.
Well, now everybody expects something different every time you put on a... You've transcended that. I didn't realize that about Craig Street, and he was, of course... perfect for that, quieter record,
yeah.
too. So.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
He's my, him and Bob Power are my mentors. They've come through for me as people and as producers, and they're my really good friends,
We're talking with Michelle Indigiocello about Comet Come to Me and other parts of her career as well. You mentioned collaborations on this new album, and there's a couple of songs that are really different in that you worked with Kenneth Fearing. Can you tell people who he is?
I wish I could have.
Well, yeah, not exactly, but with his words, I should put it that way.
Yeah. I spend my time here in Brooklyn, but my real home is in Hudson, New York, and there I'm learning how to make friends. I had to learn how to make friends. And a really good friend of mine who's jack of all trades, he introduced me to Kenneth Fearing's poetry, and him and I wrote that song together. Like, he would come up with like colors and ideas and patterns, and then I'd filter it through my mind, and that's how you got Continuous Performance and American Rhapsody, which the words just incite so many pictures, visual images for me. I was really moved by his work, and hopefully he can hear it in some other realm. It finds him well,
Let's get back to some more of these live performances from Michelle. Good Day Bad. Let's hear that one.
All right.
Thank you.
I should have tried like mad, but I did not lift a finger. I turned a good thing bad. I turned a good thing bad.
Good Day Bad, another one of the new pieces of music from Michelle and Andeguiocello, who we're having a chance to talk with today. And I have to, that has a line towards the end of it, which is, you know, I wish I knew my mom, I wish I could forgive my dad. That's pretty powerful. Can we get inside that comment a little bit? Or?
Oh. Yeah, yeah. I wish it was deeper than it seems. My mother had me at a very young age. Plus, my mother and father grew up in Jim Crow. Right. Sometimes I forget that they had a certain kind of life before 1968. And my mother suffers from some mental illness, so knowing her is difficult. Knowing her as a person has been difficult all my life. And you know, my father was just, you know, a man's man and a musician, and so we've just had our struggles.
Mm. What does he play?
He plays tenor saxophone.
Ah.
Yeah.
So how did you, you've probably been asked this a zillion times, but I don't know the answer, but how did you end up becoming a bass player?
Oh, my brother plays guitar, and his friend left it over the house, and it was just the instrument I could play that allowed him and I to play together. And then, you know, we liked Chic, which is, and Brothers Johnson, which is a guitar player and a bass player. And we just would learn songs together. And he's my first bandmate, or, you know, first person to let me play in his band.
And how did you get involved with DC's go-go scene? I know you did something.
Just from friends in high school. Plus, that was what you did back then. I mean, that was the music you had to know something of in order to find gigs. It was just something, there's just something about the tapestry of growing up in D.C. where you had to, I mean, it was big in improvisational music, jazz, funk, go-go, and, you know, then I was like a big fan of Toto or, you know, and Bad Brains and Fugazi. And, you know, so all those things just kind of filtered themselves through my mind. I mean, every tour goes through D.C., so it's a music haven.
Yeah, it is. And what you say also is it's got its own indigenous thing in zillions of genres, which is kind of cool.
And live music is really prominent there. There's always places to go hear a band. Even, you know, sidewalk cafes is something that's really alive there. A friend of mine called DC the ugly man's Hollywood. Like, there's always something going on there, you know.
That's great.
I read what a big impression hearing Prince on record had for you when you read the fact that oh my God, he's singing and playing everything. Was that something you wanted? Did you just get inside the sonic world of that, or did you actually want to do everything yourself?
Oh, I wanted to. I mean, the first two records, I do a lot of the drum programming or play the keyboards. I definitely was inspired by him and Stevie Wonder, who also had a few recordings where he was the brainchild and played everything. Prince, you know, he's been a great lesson for me about a lot of things, musically and otherwise. He was brazen. He took chances. He was exciting. He also moved through genres quite easily, I thought, early on in his career. And he had a super interesting persona, and that's what really made me go, I want to make recordings. That's what I'm going to do with my life. And so he is the impetus to all this noise I make. He's the reason I do it.
Well, it's interesting, the making recordings aspect of it, because now I'll bet the recordings probably don't pay the rent, and you have to be a live artist, which was always interesting to you as well, or was that?
Yeah, definitely. Well, I mean, yeah, that's the only thing no one can take away from you. I mean, in the sense of you have to own it, good or bad. Especially in this time of everything, the moment you do something, it's on YouTube. You have to live with that for the rest of your life. It's the ultimate god, you know. So playing live is, yes, it is how I support myself, and I've never sold a lot of recordings. I just see it as a way to get people interested, and hopefully they'll come see me live. The industry has changed a lot, but I'm trying to see it just for what it is. I don't attach an emotion or any nostalgia to it.
Into the live performance or to?
In recording and making records. I just try to stay creative. I'll always love recording. I really dig it, actually, to go and see what you can make sonically. But I love live, too, because, again, it's something no one can take away from you. It's your own personal experience.
Well, you know? I hope on this new record I am forgiven by not immediately recognizing the Houdini track that begins this thing. And I think you kind of wanted people to be like that. But what a cool reworking of this. And where did the idea for wanting to do this come up?
Well, it's kind of like... An improvisational musician, like an older jazz musician, was kind of coming down on hip-hop. And I was just like, I'm a child of that time, and I really enjoy that music. And I think it has intricacies and interesting aspects about it, especially that producer who wrote Friends, Larry Smith. And he also did the first Run DMC record. And I think those are really interesting tracks. And so I wanted to bring some life to them. In homage to him as well, homage to him. Right. And then I just think the words are funny in this day and time. It just, again, like you were saying, how I feel about, I guess, the double entendre. You know, I'm starting to question what that means. You know, what are friends? And even Conviction is a friendship breakup song.
Right.
You know, I'm like I said, I'm learning how to make new friends. Relating in today's society with social media has been a challenge for me. Also, maintaining friendships over time as you grow and change has been a challenge. So I think that song just was the opening, you know, theme for me. It's to open up this journey that you're listening to and make you look at yourself. What kind of friend are you? How do you make friends? Do I really have 2,000 friends according to Facebook? You know, how does that work?
Yeah, I was wondering what you meant about that, because you can, when you start getting on social media, you start judging yourself by the amount of people who like you, and
exactly,
it's right. Weird because you don't know these people.
Yeah, and it's like an instantaneous, like, you put a picture up there, oh my God, no one sent me any likes. It's just really, it's like high school on 100, you know.
It's true. Well, hey, it led to this track. This is cool. This is Friends.
of us have them. Friends, ones we can't depend on. Friends, how many of us have them? Friends, before we go any further, let's be friends.
Every day, but most of the time in the wrong way. No, you can look the world up again and again, but the dictionary doesn't know the meaning of friends. And if you ask me, I couldn't be much help, cause a friend is somebody you judge for yourself. Some are okay and they treat you real cool, for some mistake you count as for being a fool. They like to be with some because they're funny, others come around when they need some money. Some you grew up with around the way, and you're still real close to this very day.
Friends, friends, how many of us have them? Friends, ones we can't depend on. Friends, before we go any further, let's be friends. How many of us have them? Friends, ones we can't depend on. Friends.
That is a song you children of the 80s will recognize. Certainly the Houdini track, Friends, is reinterpreted by our guest Michelle Indeghiocello, and that's the one that leads off Comet Come to Me, the new disc. You know, we're talking a bit about this whole living in a sound world, which you love to do. And that's led to some work producing of late. What are some of the projects you're working on?
Oh, yeah. I just produced Ruthie Foster, an amazing blues singer. And I'm really proud of this project I just did with Jason Moran. It's a tribute to Fats Waller. And we've done some reworkings and rearrangements. And that comes out in September. I'm really proud of that. I'm working with some jazz musicians on Blue Note, and I'm really enjoying the producing thing because I think I have a lot to add without it being narcissistic. Like, I want to help other people bring their ideas to fruition and with their own sound. And I do know enough about sonics and hiring good engineers and personnel. And so I'm really excited to go down this path, and maybe I can save some people from doing their music just on their laptop.
That's funny. Well, and I would suspect musicians trust you as a musician a lot, right?
I mean, I love Tia Maseo. That's kind of the style I want to fall in.
Oh, cool.
I'm a good, take caller. I'm a good take caller. I think I can keep the energy and momentum up. I'm great at doing budgets so you don't go over. I want to be that kind of, create that kind of environment so that all you're thinking about on that, the moment the button is pushed for record, is expressing yourself at a high level. And I want to aid people in doing that.
Would you look towards a balance in your life between doing that and performing?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I have a 25-year-old and a 4-year-old. And I am starting to, I remember Grace Slick said this. She's like, I don't want to be 50 singing White Rabbit. Mm-hmm. And I kind of understand that, and I want to, take the gifts I do have and cultivate them and hopefully move into other realms, education, teaching. I'm working on a piece for James Baldwin that will be done at the Harlem Stage. And so, I'm just trying to keep creative and keep my mind growing and evolving. That's all.
Cool. And Michelle, thank you so much for spending some time.
Oh, thank you so much, and I enjoy your show, and I'm, again, grateful to be on here. Thank you.
Michelle Indeghiocello, our guest, and we'll be back here in a moment here on The World Cafe.